Good evening and welcome to the KRFP Evening Report for Tuesday, January 21st, 2025. I'm Lee Robartis in the news tonight. Idaho House passes Representative Bruce Skog of Nampa's minimum cannabis possession fine bill. If it becomes law, it will be the only minimum fine for a misdemeanor violation under Idaho law. We'll hear debate. Also, freshman lawmaker from Horseshoe Bend tries again with local preemption bill banning mask mandates. New Washington Attorney General sues over the Trump administration's birthright citizenship repeal executive action. And University of Idaho professors discuss centuries of rural appropriation at Renfrew Colloquium. We'll have details on those stories and more coming up on the KRFP Evening Report. And live in the KRFP studios in Moscow, Idaho, this is the KRFP Evening Report. I'm Lee Robartis. Freshman lawmaker Republican Representative Rob Beiswenger of Horseshoe Bend brought back the mask mandate ban bill in the House State Affairs Committee in Boise today. Beiswenger said the bill would prohibit government mask mandates for the purpose of preventing or slowing the spread of a contagious or infectious disease.
And I think one thing we learned from the COVID, lots of government overreach and overreaction. So trying to put some guardrails back in place, this bill would simply prohibit any government official from imposing a mask mandate for the purpose of preventing the transmission of viruses and infectious diseases and stuff like that. I would note this bill does exempt, healthcare workers. So if you're a dentist or a surgeon and you don't want your saliva going out on your patient, this you would still could be required to wear a mask mandate in that sense. Or if you're, a welder or you work with concrete and you've got mask protections to keep dust out of your lungs, it doesn't apply to anything like that.
That was Republican Representative Rob Beiswenger of Horseshoe Bend. The assertion that mask mandates might be a government overreach, considering they're credited with saving thousands of lives nationwide during the COVID pandemic, is controversial. Moscow's constitutional pandemic mask mandate was purposefully violated by the far-right Christchurch congregation in Moscow as a recruiting tool for the church. Although most citizens complied, 50 people died of COVID in Latah County and more than 100 in neighboring Whitman County during the pandemic. Democratic Representative Todd Achilles of Boise told the committee he has concerns.
I think when this comes back to committee, I am concerned that this seems much more than just guardrails on mask mandates, but it's an outright prohibition. I would like to see some medical professionals or public health professionals participate in the hearing when this comes back so we can get their perspective on it too.
Under the proposal, government agencies, schools, and other political entities, such as cities and counties, can recommend people wear masks, but they must also include a notice that it would not be mandatory. Beiswenger's bill includes exemptions for hospitals, healthcare workers, and vocational jobs where wearing protective face masks is mandatory. Republican Senator Brian Lenny of Nampa teamed up with Beiswenger to co-sponsor the bill, which closely resembles an unsuccessful bill from last year, House Bill 493. In 2024, the Idaho House of Representatives voted 46-26 to pass House Bill 493, but the Idaho Senate never took it up. In 2021, Idaho's far-right Lieutenant Governor Janice McGeehan issued an executive order banning the state, school districts, and local governments from issuing mask mandates while serving as acting governor. While Governor Brad Little was out of the state for a day, Little immediately rescinded McGeehan's executive order when he returned to Idaho. Beiswenger and Lenny's bill will return to the House State Affairs Committee for a full public hearing at a later date. Lawmakers will assign a number to the bill and publicly post it on the Idaho legislature's website after it is read on the floor of the Idaho House, likely later today or tomorrow. Republican Representative Bruce Skog of Nampa has introduced a bill that would make the firing squad the priority way of killing death row inmates. Correction Department officials have been using lethal injection as the main execution method, but a 2022 bill from SCOG became law, which allowed the firing squad as an alternative way of administering the death penalty. Last year, Correction Department officials botched an attempted execution when they could not find a suitable vein to inject the toxins. There are currently 9 inmates on Idaho's death row. SCOG said his bill would not take effect until July 2026 if passed, because that would give time for the Department of Correction to refurbish the death chamber at Kuna. The legislature has already appropriated $750,000 for the refurbishing. SCOG told the House Judiciary Rules and Administration Committee today, "This bill is not about whether the death penalty is good or bad. Our job is to make sure to carry out the most efficient manner under the bounds of the Constitution." The Idaho House today voted 54-14 in favor of Representative Bruce Scoggs' bill to set a minimum fine of $300 for possession of any amount of cannabis under 3 ounces. Possession of more than 3 ounces of cannabis in Idaho is a felony. Republican Representative Jordan Redman of Coeur d'Alene is co-sponsoring the bill with SCOG, a Republican from Nampa. The vote was mainly along party lines. House Minority Leader Elena Rubel of Boise questioned the need for such a bill when there are no mandatory minimum fines for any other misdemeanor in Idaho.
I actually think if you ask the average person in Idaho, what do you think of this penalty for a person who possessed a small amount of marijuana for personal use? I think your average person would think, whoa, that's maybe some overkill. That's a really heavy duty fine for what a lot of people would consider a fairly minor offense. I don't think we're in a crisis here where we need to set astronomically higher fines. We're now talking about adding another $300 to it, so you'd be looking at $1,000, which, as those of you who looked at your BSU survey know, that 50% of Idahoans could not pay a $1,000 hit if they were ever hit with it. They don't have $1,000 in their account or access to it. So again, this bill is not about legalizing marijuana. It's not about whether it's good for you. It's about whether we're going to set this mandatory minimum penalty on it. And I wanted to put a little bit more flesh on some of the testimony we heard in committee, because some of it's personal to me. One of the testimonials that my good friend from up north referenced was very compelling. It was from a gentleman named Sergeant Kitzhaber, who served in the U.S. Air Force for over 20 years, was a decorated American hero, and in the course of his work for our nation, he was asked to carry toxic chemicals. He was not given adequate protective gear, and he now has incurable terminal cancer throughout his entire abdomen. Has had to have more than a dozen surgeries, has had organs removed, extensive parts of his intestines removed. He is in constant agony. And his only alternative is opioids, which completely destroy his system. He's actually had to be hospitalized several times from the impact the opioids have on his system. And really, the only safe painkiller he can take is cannabis. This is not a guy who's seeking to use this for fun. This is a guy who is medically forced, and all of his cancer doctors are saying the only thing that can save you in this circumstance is medical cannabis. Again, this bill is not about medical cannabis, but it is about whether we're going to make the lives of folks like Sergeant Kitzhaber even harder. And he's not alone. He works with dozens and dozens of veterans who are in the same boat and who are forced to turn to this for their treatment. And they weren't all as brave to come out and tell their stories, but their stories are very real. So really the question is, are we going to hold them to an even more harsh standard than they already face under Idaho law? And this gets to the question of judicial discretion. This is why we have judicial discretion, so that a judge can hear all the facts of the case and look at somebody and say, you know what, you're just some punk, you're a repeat offender, we're going to give you the max. Or look at somebody and say, you know what, you're maybe a little bit different. You're a first-time offender, or maybe you're a person who's trying to bring a wife who's trying to bring cannabis home to your husband who's dying of cancer. And it gives them that little bit of flexibility to give a sentence that matches the crime. And what this bill does is strip that away to some extent. And I don't think that's the right thing to do. I got to say, every time that I've heard judicial discretion attacked in my many years here, when you look at the underlying case, the judges are usually right. When you look at it, there's usually a pretty darn good reason for their sentence. And this takes away that power for them to do that, for them to tailor that case and to tailor the punishment to the crime insofar as it goes. Now, we've heard a lot about deterrence, but deterrence isn't the only thing our criminal justice system is supposed to accomplish. It has a variety of things it's trying to accomplish, because if it were only deterrence, we would chop people's hands off for shoplifting or give the death penalty for every offense. We have more things we're trying to accomplish than that with the criminal justice system. We're trying to accomplish, certainly, punishment, rehabilitation, proportionality, justice. And let's talk about proportionality. As my good colleague mentioned, this would make possession of a small amount of marijuana for personal use a more severe crime by means of penalty than strangulation, domestic battery, stalking, DUI, bribery of a public servant, aggravated assault. Again, getting back to my person on the street test, if you walked up to just about any Idahoan in the state and said, what do you think is a more serious crime? Possession of a gummy in your pocket for personal use, or attempted strangulation, or DUI, or stalking? I have a pretty good idea of what pretty much every single person in the state of Idaho would say to that question. They would say, we've got this upside down. This is not a more serious offense than any of those things. And not that I'm saying we should have mandatory minimums for everything. I think we should stick with the principle of judicial discretion across the board. And I just don't think it makes sense to single out this one offense and treat it so much more harshly than everything else in our whole sphere of misdemeanors. Nor do I think it's needed. We have not had this law on the books before. We are not Portland. We are not Seattle. We don't need it. Judges are doing a great job with the discretion that they have. Marijuana will still be illegal. It would still be subject to extremely harsh penalties without this bill. And I wanted to just briefly debunk the idea that, oh, $300 isn't a big deal. There was a number thrown out that marijuana costs $240. That's for an ounce of highly pure. I don't know what that was talking about, but an average gummy, I think, would be about $2. So again, piling on the court costs, you're talking about a $1,000 penalty. A person who can afford a $2 gummy, it does not follow that they have $1,000 to pay this fine. So this would actually be extremely severe and would put a lot of people in hock for a very long time.
That was Democratic Representative Elena Rubel of Boise speaking on the House floor today. Republican Representative Dale Hawkins of Fernwood spoke in favor of the bill.
So we keep talking about the judge's discretion. I want to remind everybody that court costs are not fines. Court costs are incurred by everybody who goes to court for a criminal action or a misdemeanor or a felony. And in the state of Idaho, I heard it brought up today that this is greater and more serious in a fine than it is for strangulation. Attempted strangulation in the state of Idaho is a felony, and you can be put in prison for up to 15 years for that. That's not what we're talking about. As far as discretion, this is a minimum fine. The judge can fine from $300 to $1,000. The jail time is 0 days to a year in jail. And in the case that was read, it was said that it was 180 days in jail. It wasn't read that it was 178 days suspended. So they spent 2 days in jail.
That was Republican Representative Dale Hawkins of Fernwood. Five Republicans in the House joined the nine Democrats in opposing the bill. The Republicans who voted against the bill were Representatives Kevin Andrews of Lava Hot Springs, Robert Beiswanger of Horseshoe Bend, David Cannon of Blackfoot, Jack Nelson of Jerome, and Mark Stewart of Sandpoint. The bill now heads to the Senate. You're tuned in to the KRFP Evening Report. This is KRFP Moscow Pullman.
This program is made possible by KRFP members and the Palouse Peace Coalition. Palouse Peace Coalition is a consistent presence for peace since 2001. The Palouse Peace Coalition shares KRFP's progressive values and hosts a weekly peace vigil Fridays from 3 to 4 p.m. in Moscow's Friendship Square.
For information on becoming a KRFP underwriter, go to krfp.org and click Support KRFP.
Don't touch that dial. You got it right.
We're up in the morning when it first gets light, and we do it all day. Then we're up all night so you can listen to the radio.
You got it right.
got it right.
Listen, listen, anytime you listen, everybody's on a mission, and there ain't nothing missing when you listen to the radio. Listen to the radio.
You got it right.
Community radio.
Listen, and you give a little listen to the radio.
Radio Free Moscow.
Fight Back Radio. It's 90.3 on your radio dial. Fight Back.
Thanks for tuning in, and thanks for your support. So keep on listening and listening and listening.
Fight back.
We're still here.
Radio.
Still here.
Fight back. Fight back. Fight back. Fight back.
The Idaho Senate voted unanimously yesterday to approve Alex Adams as Health and Welfare Department Director. Adams has been in charge of the department and its $5 billion budget since May, when Governor Brad Little appointed him. The appointment requires Senate approval. Before Governor Little appointed him as head of the state's largest department, Adams served as economic advisor to the governor. Adams replaces Director Dave Jeppesen, who retired in December 2023. Department of Insurance Director Dean Cameron has been interim director of the health department since December 2023. Adams takes over the department at a perilous time for people's health, as some Idaho lawmakers say they plan to bring proposals to repeal Medicaid expansion this year, which nearly 61% of Idaho voters approved in 2018. Yesterday, President Trump signed an executive order withdrawing the United States from the World Health Organization and said his administration would stop negotiating a proposed World Health Organization pandemic treaty, which would require signers to increase infectious disease monitoring, share data, and work to prevent epidemics from spreading worldwide. Schweitzer Engineering Laboratories in Pullman has announced CEO Dave Whitehead will take over as president. According to the Daily News, company president Ed Schweitzer asked the board of directors to change his position from president to founder. Ed Schweitzer, who started the company, which has grown into an international manufacturer of electric grid components, said he wants to spend more time as a mentor, investor, collaborator, and teacher. Whitehead has worked for the company for 30 years after joining as a hardware engineer. He ran the research and development division for more than 10 years and then took the jobs of chief operations officer and then later Chief Economic Officer. The Moscow City Council tonight will vote on submitting a claim in the class action lawsuit against Visa and MasterCard for wrongfully inflating interchange fees. Because the city was one of the merchants paying Visa or MasterCard interchange fees between January 1, 2004 and January 25, 2019, it is eligible to submit a claim for some of the $5.5 billion settlement. The Moscow City Council will meet at 7 p.m. tonight at City Hall.
The Service Employees International Union is joining the AFL-CIO, a move that both groups say will make it easier for more workers to unionize. SEIU is the nation's largest union of healthcare workers, janitors, and security officers, among others. Combined with the AFL-CIO, a federation of over 60 national and international labor unions, the group now has 15 million members. Alan Dubinsky is with SEIU Local 49, representing Oregon and Southwest Washington. He says the two unions have a history of working together, and they share many of the same values.
We want to unite people across class lines, no matter where they live, no matter the color of their skin, who they love, so we can stand up to billionaire interests and corporate greed.
Research shows, although only 1 in 10 workers is currently part of a union, more than 60 million people say they would join a union if they could. In a statement, the AFL-CIO says they will fight for new rules to strengthen the rights of workers to organize and collectively bargain. Recent polls show unions have near record high favorability, with 67% of Americans approving of them. Last year had some major wins for labor, including the United Auto Workers, unions representing airline workers, and several Hollywood entertainment unions. Dubinsky says rights for workers can't be won alone.
As working people, we all want the same things. You know, we want jobs that are going to pay us enough to live. We want accessible, affordable, quality health care for ourselves, for our loved ones.
When workers organize, research shows wages increase and working conditions improve. In 2024, petitions to form or join a union more than doubled from the previous year. I'm Isabel Charlet, Oregon News Service.
Washington's new state attorney general, Nick Brown, announced today Washington is leading a multi-state federal lawsuit challenging President Donald Trump's order that would unilaterally strip citizenship from Americans across the United States, including thousands of people who were born in Washington. Oregon, Arizona, and Illinois joined the lawsuit, which Brown filed in U.S. District Court for the Western District of Washington. The lawsuit says President Trump's executive order yesterday to end birthright citizenship in the United States violates the 14th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution and the Federal Immigration and Nationalization Act. The 14th Amendment to the Constitution says all persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States. The Immigration and Nationality Act states a person born in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof is a national and a citizen of the U.S. at birth. The lawsuit declares the president has no authority to override the Constitution and that no constitutional provision or law empowers him to determine who should or should not be granted U.S. citizenship at birth. Brown said, "My commitment to this office and to all the people of Washington is we will be prepared. We will do everything in our power to defend the rights of Washingtonians." President Trump's executive order is called Protecting the Meaning and Value of American Citizenship. It says a child born in the United States must have at least one parent who is either an American citizen or legal permanent resident to automatically become a U.S. citizen. Brown's lawsuit seeks to block federal agencies from acting on Trump's order and prevents any federal agency from using the order to deny the privileges of citizenship, including passports, social security numbers, health care benefits, to babies born in Washington, Oregon, Arizona, and Illinois. During a press conference today, Brown called the executive order unconstitutional, un-American, and cruel, and he said it attempts to redefine what it means to be American. If the lawsuit does not stop it, the order is set to take effect Wednesday, February 19th. One of the ongoing aspects of colonization in North America is the activity of elites appropriating the rural landscape, a process that has been going on for hundreds of years. Two speakers at the University of Idaho Renfrew Interdisciplinary Colloquium today spoke about how elites cast aspersions about rural communities in public discourse, which is then used as an excuse to appropriate. History professor Dr. Alyssa Krekemeyer showed a 1755 map by a British cartographer.
The two things that I find particularly telling in terms of the inheritance of an Anglo perspective of the U.S. settler state are, one, the vast just emptiness, right, of the West. There's no more continent, there's nothing there. Even geographical features tend to fall out. We have rivers, but little else. The other thing I'd like to point out is the lines, that it imposes this kind of political imaginary, right, across the actual physical geography, not to mention the many diverse villages, towns, civilizations, and residents that already inhabited the space.
Krekemeyer said during the 1800s, the idea of the empty frontier was prominent.
Certainly, while we can find early stories and examples of the frontier, even in pre-colonial discourse, by the 19th century, the frontier is really everywhere in culture. And in fact, just two centuries later, historians begin to grapple with it and give us this tremendous legacy in terms of the stories that the nation tells itself about its own history. So there's a key moment in demographic data in 1890 where the United States Census finds that for the first time, at least one resident, as they were counting residents, recall at the time, this is from the perspective of the U.S. settler state, at least one resident inhabits every square mile of the continent from coast to coast. And so for the historian Frederick Jackson Turner, this poses some interesting challenges, and he writes up this story. He gives an address in 1893 to the American Historical Association, and he suggests that it's really this frontier, this particular powerful image of a westward moving frontier of open land that makes Americans, again, a certain kind of American, I think, exceptional, and that it was through taming the wilderness that they're able to cast off their European sensibilities and become truly American. It was that free, open land that Turner focuses on, quote, free, open, empty land, that allowed these pioneer frontiers to become truly American, right? To develop a sense of rugged individualism, and from that place be able to self-govern themselves.
Professor Krekemeyer spoke about the demographic shifts in rural areas starting at the beginning of the 20th century.
And so despite the fact that at the turn of the 20th century, African-American farmers owned and operated just under 900,000 farms, mid-century, as there was growing interest in many white populations moving from cities back to the country, that ownership began to decline sharply. And by 1970, there were only 45,000 remaining farms that were still owned and operated by African Americans. Perhaps ironically, Native Americans continued to live on tribal lands at the time, of course, and had continued to advocate for access to their ancestral lands and cultural ways. However, there was an irony in that as the federal government was supporting poor white farmers through the resettlement agency, it came up with a termination policy, which by 1953 moved at least 100,000 and likely by the 1970s, nearly a million Native Americans off of tribal lands into cities. And this is a poster from the Bureau of Indian Affairs, who managed a policy in the 1960s relocating Native Americans. At the same time, the image of the white college-educated back to the lander is also a bit too simple. There were definitely marginalized groups who sought freedom and found freedom of expression in ways that they couldn't in many parts of America through moving into rural areas. So this image on the right here is from the Alianza Federal de Mercedes. This was a group of Hispanic landowners in New Mexico. When the United States signed the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo with Mexico in 1848, a war which Mexico refers to as the invasion of North America, by the way, it promised in that treaty that it would uphold all of these Spanish land grants. So well before the U.S. was anywhere near the western half of the continent, there were many land grants that Hispanic families and their descendants had legal claim to. Despite the treaty, by the 20th century, something like 75% of those land grants had been inhabited by Anglos in New Mexico.
That was University of Idaho history professor Alyssa Krekemeyer. The other speaker at today's Renfrew Colloquium was visiting Harvard professor Matt Smith. Smith spoke about some of the positive trends in rural culture in recent decades. He gave one example from Green River, Utah.
So while Green River is very small, it has about 1,000 people, and it's relatively remote. It's you might encounter it on your way to Moab if you drive down from Salt Lake. It actually acts sort of as a connector as well. So they're organizing biannual summits like this one that was pictured here. They'll have another one in the spring that actually Allie was involved in organizing, where they bring in other rural architects, artists, organizers, and leaders from around the country, and then they spend time with one another. Talking about their work, sharing lessons learned, and really kind of elevating their experiences and their traditions and culture from the rural spaces that they're from. So I think the common thread here is that their episode is really focusing on the social. So that they might be in a small town, but they're extremely connected to other small towns all across the country through the leaders that participate in these summits and come and contribute to that community. The last organization I'll look at is one that's called the Win It Aces, and they're operating in one of the least populated counties in one of our nation's most rural states, just east of here in Montana. So Win It itself has about 188 residents, and the whole county, Petroleum County, has just shy of 500. So the ACEs focus on soil health and sustainable land management practices, but they also have an eye towards the next generation, and they developed a grass bank so younger ranchers can access land and build equity by expanding their herds. The organization is also focused on strengthening social infrastructure by building and restoring spaces for the community members. They built a new community center and opened that about a year ago. And then they're focusing on the adaptive reuse of communities along their downtown, including Courthouse and an Oddfellows Hall. So owing in part to its small population and its remote location in the middle of the state, the ACEs sort of work with what they've got. Right? They are fiercely bipartisan, and they're proud that they can bridge their differences. And you know, this is actually not uncommon in many small communities. Rural leaders are often having to do double duty as mayors and county commissioners and school board members while also working full-time as teachers or nurses or ranchers and farmers. And I think the ethic underlying this public service typifies what many consider part of their rural identity, this resilience, this resourcefulness, the reciprocity. And one of the leaders told me in a conversation a couple years ago about this idea of reciprocity and his take on civics, which is that we treat each other well because we all know it'll eventually be our turn to sit on the county commission or serve on the school board.
That was visiting Harvard professor Matt Smith speaking at the Renfrew Colloquium at the University of Idaho today. KRFP citizen journalist Brenda Cox assisted with this story. Well, that's it for the KRFP Evening Report for tonight. Taking a look at the weather forecast for the Moscow-Pullman area. Clear skies through Thursday. Low 18 tonight, high 32 tomorrow. Low 20 Wednesday night, high 34 on Thursday. If you want to help KRFP keep newscasts like this on the air, plus the newscasts you hear during Morning Mix, the recordings of local events and the public affairs shows, plus the music and arts programming you hear every day on KRFP, be sure to become a member of KRFP. Memberships are $35 a year, $20 for students and low income. You can mail your memberships to KRFP, 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843, or you can go to the KRFP website to find out more ways to help KRFP.